Colonel W.J. Heimlich was the chief of U.S. intelligence in Berlin. He was in charge of determining what happened to Adolf Hitler. After finishing his investigation, he had this to say. He said, there's no evidence beyond that of hearsay to support the theory of Hitler's suicide on the basis of present evidence. No insurance company in America would pay a claim on Adolf Hitler. In 1952, Dwight Eisenhower said, we have been unable to unearth one bit of tangible evidence of Hitler's death. Of course, if you've seen any of the more recent documentaries, you know there were some DNA tests on remains taken out of the bunker. We're going to get to that a little bit later as we continue our conversation with Harry Cooper about his book, Hitler in Argentina. Stay with us. Harry Cooper, let's take a step back and talk about the key witness, the key source of information for your book, Hitler in Argentina. His name is Don Angel Alcazar de Velasco. He sent you this 114-page letter that said that he worked for the Reich. Tell us who he was and what you were able to confirm about his background.
Okay. Don Angel was indeed a Spaniard working for the Reich. He was early on, he was involved in something called Operation Willy. He was not a very good agent. He failed at a lot of things. Operation Willy, now in the early stages of the war, King Edward VIII abdicated the throne to marry the American divorcee, Wallace Simpson. And so he was given the title Duke of Windsor. And he was living in Portugal. He was living the high life, enjoying everything, and so Germany decided they would have Don Angel befriend the Duke and invite him on a hunting trip into Spain, where the SS would grab Edward VIII and hold him for ransom, because Hitler kept trying to make peace proposals, which Churchill always just shot down. So they figured if they had the king, they could maybe force a peace proposal. Well, it failed. The king, the Duke of Windsor, decided he didn't want to go hunting in Spain. And he had a couple other operations that went kind of badly that never came to fruition. But the one thing he did, he helped Martin Bormann get out of Germany down to Argentina by submarine after the war ended. And German submarines had been popping up for quite some time after the war ended. And Don Angel rode one of them down there. They called them the Black Boats. These were submarines that didn't exist on paper, much like our SR-71s that were assigned to the CIA. They didn't exist.
And this is sort of, again, this is sort of how you got into the story, is because you're looking at U-boats.
Right.
You love researching U-boats and their crews and what their missions were.
Exactly.
So
this came as an offshoot.
You were able to confirm, I guess, with your NSA guy that this Don Angel really was a spy, that he really did work for the Nazis, right?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Like I say, he was in my living room when we lived in Tampa. And just as calm as could be, he said, yeah, we knew Hitler was alive. We knew he didn't get killed in the bunker. And he said, whenever we'd grab another high-ranking party official or an SS officer, first thing we'd grill him on is, where's Hitler? So they knew he was out. And as I say, we have so many files from the FBI. And you're starting to see these files float around on the Internet now. People are just amazed, oh God, you know, Hitler got away and all this, and they show some of these FBI files. These are files that our guy in D.C. got declassified 6 or 7 years ago, and they're now public domain.
Yeah, I was amazed. I first saw him a week ago when I started prepping for this interview, and an article popped up, and I thought, holy cow, that's I didn't know about that. Tell me more about Don Angel, though, and how he ended up in the bunker. There comes a time when other people figure out that he's a spy and his life is in danger there in Spain, so he has to get out.
Yeah, that was fairly early on, or mid-war, I guess. A British agent, and I think there was an American agent, were waiting for him, and one of his underlings, a guy named Conrado Blanco, which obviously is a pseudonym that means Conrad White, I'm assuming it's a pseudonym, invited him over, and when he got there, the American agent and the British agent were waiting for him. They were going to take him back to England and debrief him, which I guess means early waterboard or something. He escaped, and he had to leave Madrid. And then he was living in various different places and finally settled down in, I can't remember where it was, but he was still working for the government, the German government, as a spy, as an agent. And then he was called up after the war was over, shortly thereafter, and told that he was going to be contacted by a very important person. And then it that turned out to be Martin Bormann. And so he, as you read in the book, he spent some time teaching Martin Bormann how to speak Spanish the Argentine way, which is quite a different Spanish than any other country speaks. Like, for instance, V-I-L-L-A, it's pronounced Villa any place except down in South, in Argentina, it's Villa. And they have different customs, and so he taught Martin Bormann all the customs, etc. And then he went down to Argentina with Bormann. They landed at a little town called Puerto Coig, way, way south on the Patagonian coast. And then they said the submarine was going to go back to a point about halfway between there and Buenos Aires, and they were going to scuttle the boat. Well, we have found in this Caleta de los Loros, there's supposedly at least one, if not two, German U-boats scuttled. We've got aerial pictures of it, but when people go there to find them and dive them in shallow water, they can't find them. And that's a riddle. We don't have an answer for that. I mean, people have spent millions of dollars with the help of the Argentine Navy, and they still haven't found them, and they're supposed to be in very shallow water. You don't even need scuba. You just snorkel down to them, supposedly. But you can see them on extremely low tides. When the wind is blowing out, part of it is breaking the surface. But they're not there when divers go. Don't ask me. All I have is what my people tell me. I'm trying to get together some money to go down there. I'm scuba certified, and go down there and look for myself.
I want to back up for a second. Unless I misunderstood this, wasn't Don Angel in Berlin in the bunker? Did I misread that, or is
no? Yeah. You read it correctly. Towards
all right.
The end of, I'm sorry, I skipped over that. Towards
yeah,
the
let's
end of the
let's
war,
go. Yeah, let's go back to the bunker, because he met Hitler, which is a pretty amazing
exactly.
Little series of events, right?
Well, he was based in various different German cities, and then their headquarters got bombed out, and they moved to another one, and finally, about 3-4 months before the war was ended, he was posted into the Führer bunker with Colonel Willy Oberbeil and another colonel down in the bunker. And one of his jobs was to make a report to Hitler every morning. And so he knew who Hitler was. He recognized him, et cetera. And one day, if you remember in the book, he said he heard a commotion in the hall down in the bunker, 60 or 70 feet down below. And so he went to the door to see what it was, and that's when Hitler had been forcibly drugged under orders of Martin Bormann, Hitler and Eva Braun, and they were leaving the bunker, and Hitler was semi-conscious and just barely able to walk. And he looked at Don Angel, who he had seen every day with a report, and he said, "Where goes this man without a motive?" And away they went. So he saw the double come in, and forensic researchers, scientists, whatever, excuse me, have compared photos of the real Hitler with the double. For instance, the guy you saw in the last photo op of Hitler, where he's a bent-up old man patting the Hitler Youth guys as he's inspecting the Hitler Youth out in front. The ears are different. The nose is different. It ain't him.
So Hitler is hunkered down in this bunker. Mm-hmm. Your guy, Don Angel, is assigned there. He sees him all the time.
Yep.
And he says right on the day that supposedly Hitler died, the real Hitler left the bunker and an actor or a double came in.
Right. Martin Bormann wanted to keep the Reich alive, which he did. And he felt he needed Hitler as a figurehead. As it turned out, apparently he didn't, because Hitler had no more part in the new movement down in Argentina. He just lived out his life in this biggest state. You've seen pictures in the book. I was there. It was built at the end of the war by with Mercedes money, and nobody ever lived there except Hitler and Eva Braun. It's described in the book when Don Angel said that he had flown down to Antarctica, which that is not correct. It was either a mistake, because all of Argentina looks the same from the air in the wintertime, or it's deliberate disinformation, because he described the area where he landed the buildings, et cetera, and it's exactly like the estate called Inauco, which is where Hitler lived. And it's been deserted ever since Hitler moved out in 1955, I think, and it's for sale. It's been for sale as long as I've known it, for 40 million Yankee dollars. It's a huge piece of property, a very nice estate building, and there's pictures on the website. Fortunately, I learned to pick locks when I was working for the Mustaches in Chicago, and I let myself in, took a bunch of photos, and there are guest cottages, and there's a small building right close to the main house where they had the heat, and the steam would come under in underground pipes, and they had another building to cook in. They had another building to produce electricity, and you could only get to this estate by water. It's at the end of a long finger on this lake, Nahuelhuapi. And if you come from one direction, and you see the pictures in my book, you have to pass this tower, and they would have maybe one or two platoons of people in there, and their sole purpose was to observe. And if any boat came by there headed towards Hitler's home, they would notify the estate. And if a boat came from the other direction, there was a bunker, which was not a combat bunker, but just a housing facility. And their job was the same, to notify the estate if a boat was coming by. The bunker was blown up in 1960 in a military exercise teaching the Army how to blow things up.
Hey, Harry, I want to jump back because, I mean, Don Angel's story is sort of the heart of this book, and we keep jumping over it. But he's in the bunker with Hitler. He sees Hitler leave.
That's right.
And then, and, you know, those who say that nobody could get out because the Red Army was there, Don Angel got out. He and some others went in a convoy and, like, were the last guys to get out of Berlin, right?
Right, before the Red Army closed the ring. One sector, I think it was the Southwest, I'm not sure, but there was one part where the Red Army had not quite closed it off, and he got out. And he was one of a 20 or 22-car convoy full of people, high-ranking military officers, SS people, party members, 20 or 22 cars that got out. And as you read in the book, they were partly down, quite a ways down the road, and they got attacked by a fighter, and a couple cars got blown up. And they went down to this place called Rottach am Egern, which is down in Bavaria. And each car was assigned a place to go so that people would get shuffled off into the right direction. And he was in one of those cars, he and Colonel Wagner and Willy Obergeil.
Okay, so he gets out. He gets out of Berlin. We fast forward a little bit, and then he finds himself on a submarine with Martin Bormann heading for Argentina. And Bormann tells him, fills in some of the blanks, right? What did Bormann tell him about Hitler?
Well, he didn't tell him too much about Hitler at that time, but then Don Angel was still working for the Reich. They're still going today. But he was based in Mexico City, and he was a newspaper reporter. One of his duties was to keep track of two children who were going to school in Las Cruces, New Mexico. A boy named Adolfo, who was 16 years old, I think, in 1952, and a girl named Stern, which is the German word for star. We don't know who these are. We can make assumptions, but we don't know who these kids were. But they went to school in Las Cruces, and he was to keep a dossier on the two children, take photos. And one of our friends is the former superintendent of education in superintendent of schools there in Las Cruces, and he's trying to back check to find anybody named Adolfo and Stern in 1952 to see if we can figure out who these kids were. But then in 52, Don Angel was ordered to take the dossiers and the photos and go down to South America. He was picked up by another plane and flown down, he said, to Antarctica. But as I say, that can't be. I don't believe it. He landed there at Inalco, and he was ushered into a dormitory building. The next morning, he had breakfast and went into the orderly room, and the colonel asked, did you bring the photos and the dossier? Yes, he has them here. And the colonel told him, go through the door into the next room and give your report to the Fuhrer. And Don Angel said, the Fuhrer, what do you mean when you say the Fuhrer? And the colonel looked at him like he was mad, and he said, there's only one Fuhrer, Adolf Hitler. And Don Angel went in, and there were three officers standing, putting pins and maps or something on the wall. It's in the book. And, a slumped figure, as he calls it, at the desk. And the man at the desk, Hitler, if indeed that was Hitler, that's the way Don Angel put it, had no more mustache. He had gone bald. His left arm just trembled badly, and it didn't work. And he asked if he had brought the pictures and the dossiers, and he did. He gave him, I think it was about 60-something photos. And the guy at the desk, Hitler, looked over everything, and then after a short period of time, just waved his hand, and that meant the interview was over. Then he was ordered back down to, he went back down to see Martin Bormann in 1958, and he asked, how was Hitler? He asked Martin Bormann if his plans to resurrect the Reich were coming along okay. Bormann said they had changed their ultimate goals. Don Angel asked him, well, what of the Fuhrer? I guess he meant, how does the Fuhrer figure into this? And Bormann said, that doesn't matter anymore. And Don Angel asked, does that mean he's dead? And Bormann said, it's not important anymore. So that's the last of it. And Don Angel resigned, went back to Madrid with his wife and child. And that was the end of his attachment with the Reich.
Give me your assessment, Harry, how credible he is now that you've had time to digest this and you've, tracked down other leads, talked to other witnesses. How credible you find his story? I mean, he was a spy, a spook who was known to, spread disinformation when it was necessary. Obviously, this is late in his life when he tells you this story. So how, 1 to 10, where does it rank credibility wise?
Absolutely. Absolutely credible. Not only because we believe him and because other spies like Captain Bob Thu and a couple of German double agents I know, they confirmed he was who he said he was. But all the rest of the stuff we have learned falls into place and confirms and props up his story. There's no point where we find any negatives about his story. Everything he said is proving out to be true. Hitler did indeed get to Argentina. Bormann did get to Argentina. I went to the Plaza Hotel this past time because it was alleged that Martin Bormann lived there for a year or two after the war was over with two young women. So he gets high rates in my book for that one. But we went to the hotel. I went up and spoke to Senora Rodriguez, nice lady, and I explained what I was doing there, and I said, we have reason to believe that Martin Bormann lived in this hotel after the war was over. And without batting an eye, and she said, yes, in room 470, the presidential suite. I said, what, you knew he was here? She said, sure, we all knew it. She didn't know about the two young women, though. She blushed when I said that. But she said, we all knew he lived here. And that was before he moved elsewhere. But it was no secret to anybody down there. Perón, for instance, made a speech, and as you saw it in the book, he said, we shall never forget nor ever be able to repay the immense debt of gratitude we owe to our comrades in the German army. And he made that speech in 1952. What's he doing making a speech like that 7 years after the war ended. They were there. And we have a ton of pictures of good-looking German army guys with German equipment, German guns, German half-tracks, German machine guns. But they weren't German. They were Argentine.
Yes. We'll get into that when we come back. And then I want you to tell me what you think became of Hitler, how long he lived, where he died, why the Mossad or the FBI didn't go in and try to snatch him when they got these tips that he was still alive. Sammy Hagar takes us into the break here on Coast to Coast AM. Harry Cooper is my guest. His book, Hitler in Argentina, fascinating stuff. If you're a history buff, especially, what became of the Führer? If he really did make it to Argentina, how long did he live down there? Could he have gone on to another country, as some people suspect, or did he die down there? And if so, what about the remains? We'll get into that and more, and a little bit later, be opening up the phone lines with your questions here on Coast to Coast AM. Harry Cooper, I think I remember reading in your book, I think it's only one line, but it mentioned about a plastic surgery operation that was attached to a hotel that was frequented by German expatriates. Did I read that correctly?
Yeah, you did. There were actually two hotels. The one you're referring to was built with German money at the very end of the war, the Hotel Vienna with one N, which I guess is the Spanish spelling. And it was up in Cordoba province, about 400 miles northwest of Buenos Aires, which again was out in the middle of nowhere. This was a beautiful modern hotel built on the shore of a huge salt lake in the little village of Miramar, and it was three or four stories high. It had air conditioning in 1945. Who had air conditioning? I never even heard of it, and I was a kid back in those days. There was no such thing, but they had air conditioning. They had elevators, and they had a plastic surgery clinic. They also had a 60-meter-high lookout tower. Well, why would you need a lookout tower for a resort hotel? I think you can fill in the blanks on that. Well, then, for whatever reason, some years after the war was over, for whatever reason, the water in the lake started to rise and rise and rise, and it the lake got so high, it completely engulfed the entire first floor all the way up to the ceiling. So obviously, the hotel was abandoned. The lake receded, and the ruins of the hotel are still there, and it's all fenced off. And, of course, they got the signs up there that says No Passar, which means the same as Eingang Verboten, which I've learned means Harry is welcome here.
Yeah, right. Yeah.
So, again, I picked the lock and went in. We never touch anything. We never take anything. We never hurt anything. We take photos and we take videos, and that's it. So we spent about almost 2 hours going through this hotel where they still have old paintings on the wall and photos on the wall of German cities and German scenes, etc. And so those photos are on the website too, sharkhunters.com, and click on previous tours. And then a workman appeared, and he seemed somewhat excited to find a couple of gringos in the hotel that weren't supposed to be there, so we decided we should leave. And we were about 2 hours away, and my translator's cell phone rang. We're out in the middle of nowhere. And, oh, si, senora. Oh, si, senora. Oh, no, por favor, senora. No policia. No policia. No policia. So he talked her out of sending the police after us. Because
it was clear you didn't have a reservation. You weren't in the hotel. With,
that's right. Yeah. And there was no bellhop to take our bags.
Let me ask you this, Harry. I mean, is it the fact that they would have plastic surgery operations attached to these hotels frequented by Germans suggests that maybe that was part of the sort of the Underground Railroad, that once you got into the system operated by, I guess, Odessa, that was an option for somebody to have a different look?
Absolutely correct. And also there were plastic surgery clinics down in Bariloche as well. Plus, there was a compound, which you read about in the book. Now, this place is also in the Cordoba province. I forget what little village it's by. But it exists today, the abandoned compound. You're going down a four-lane modern highway, and there'll be a crack in the trees just about 15 feet wide. You got to know where to look for it. We knew where it was. We blew past it. We had to come around and go in. And you go in this little dirt road, There's pictures of this on the website, too. You go in this little dirt road, and right away there's an abandoned building that had been the guard house, et cetera. It was about a 5 or 6 room building. It's abandoned. Then you go maybe a quarter mile or so, and there's a tunnel, and it's only wide enough for one car, not even big enough for a truck to pass through probably. And we've got a photo of the tunnel during the days of the German occupation, where they had two cars parked diagonally to where you couldn't go by them until you were cleared by a guard. Then you go through the tunnel, then you come out the other side. It's a short tunnel, and you go for about, every bit of a mile back into the forest, and suddenly there's this whole compound in front of you. There's the Baño Caldera, which I think means hot baths, the latrines. The water still works. There's a headquarters building, the orderly room. There's barracks building, and there's a huge swimming pool, and it's all abandoned. There's also a chapel, what do you call it, a place where there's a religious icon in a grotto with an artesian well, so there's water still flowing in it. And we did research, and we found this was where many people would come after the war to get their new identities, get their new papers, and be sent to whatever city, village, town they were going to live in.
I remember there was a great book, and then it became a movie called The Odessa Files. I think it's Robert Ludlum, about a German journalist who infiltrates Odessa. That's the organization.
Right.
Tell me about how powerful that organization was, and then is.
Yes, was is not the proper term. General Otto Kuhn from the SS, he was one of the guys who put it together, but Scorzini helped, and it was primarily to help people get out of Germany down to primarily South America. Some people went to the Middle East, but the huge majority went to South America, primarily Argentina, because they had a friendly government with Juan Perón. And once they got down to South America, they got directed to, like I say, to this compound or to wherever they were going. I lost my train of thought there for a minute.
Well, we're talking about how much, how well organized Odessa was in those days. I guess they had all this loot and plunder from around the world, so they had plenty of resources.
Well, they had a ton of money, even though during her rainbow tour to Europe in 1947, Evita surreptitiously transferred some of the money out of the joint accounts from Juan Perón and Bormann into personal accounts of Juan Perón, and lifted about 3/4 of the loot from Bormann, but they still had a massive amount of money. And this guy, Ludwig Freude, he was, it means joy. Freude is a German word for joy. He was the guy helping funnel money in to help the guys through Die Spinne, or as Ludlum put it, Odessa, organization of the SS.
And, so what about now?
Well, one of my friends down there, a guy named Abel Basti, who is an incredible researcher in South America, probably the best researcher in Argentina on the Germans down there, he contacted this woman, Catalina Camaro, who was the waitress who waited on Hitler and Eva Braun in the Eden Hotel in La Falda, in Cordova province, in 1949, 4 years after the alleged suicide. And the woman was speaking freely with him. This was in 2002. And she said she had photos and she would be happy to talk to him. So he drove all the way up from Patagonia, about 1,000 kilometers. She met him at the door and said, "I cannot talk to you. They told me I cannot speak with you while the lady is still alive." So from that, we infer Eva Braun was still alive in 2002, which is not impossible. She was born in 1912. It would have made her 90. My grandma was 92 when she died, so it's not impossible. But then after some years after that, Catalina did speak with another one of my people down there, and she said that Hitler did visit in 1949, and that interview is in the book. You read it. And Hitler did not stay in the hotel, but stayed in the annex, which was about 200 meters away, and that's where my translator and I stayed. Beautiful, huge, old building, probably 16 guest rooms, I guess, with 12-foot-high double doors, just a beautiful old place, and just reeking with history.
Well, what about Odessa now? I mean, in the movie, I know it's just a movie, but they were pretty tough guys, and anybody poking around trying to track down Nazis could face danger. Are they dangerous now? It would have to be the children or grandchildren of whichever Nazis got out of Germany.
That's correct. Obviously, the guys who left Germany are either dead or they're in their 90s. but we were in Villa Vicia General Belgrano a couple of years ago, which is up in Cordova. This is where the crew of the Graf Spee went and resettled after they blew up their ship. And I was in a gift store. I wanted to get something for my wife and kids. And I don't speak Spanish, and of course the guy doesn't speak English, but I remembered the restaurant, so I asked him if he spoke German, sprechen Sie Deutsch. Oh, no, por favor, momentito, and he's on the phone, yakety-yak. 5 minutes later, this good-looking young man, about 30 years old, 6 foot tall, blue eyes, blonde hair, shows up, and we're talking in German. He helped me translate, and I bought some stuff for my wife and kids, and his grandfather had been a lieutenant general as an adjutant in the Panzer Corps working with General Panzermeier. So between those things, we know there are certain parts of Argentina, and I'm not going to go any farther into it than just this comment. There are parts of Argentina that if you go there, you don't come out.
Well, you have pictures in the book, and I've seen them elsewhere of these rallies, these German pro-Nazi swastika-type rallies, the big rallies that they held in South America at one point, pretty openly.
Yeah, still.
Tell me this, what became a Hitler? What's your best guess on how long he lived and the circumstances of his death?
Our best estimate, he died in the early 1960s, old age, failing health. The guy was in horrible shape at the end of the war. He allegedly had Parkinson's. You know, people who see pictures of him there with his mouth drooping on one side and his left hand trembling. they felt he had Parkinson's. And when Don Angel went to visit him in 1952, he said his left hand was practically useless. So he was in bad shape. He was in, his health was failing. Even, you know, in those days, they didn't have the modern medicine that they have today. So we our best projection is that he died in the early 60s.
Any idea about the body?
It's dead.
Yeah, about being where the remains would be, or
would you want to know, George?
Well, I think I probably would like to know. That's why I asked you.
no, I don't know, but I mean, if anybody who knows, either the neo-Nazis would be on your doorstep wanting to know where he was buried to make a shrine out of it, or the Mossad would be there to stick bamboo splints under your fingernails to find it. So I don't want to know, and I don't know.
Tell me this. You had mentioned about the photographs that that Don Angel had brought down, photos of these teenagers living in the United States.
Right.
Are you suggesting they're somehow Hitler's offspring or relatives, think?
That's merely a guess. Merely a guess, and it's not necessarily my guess. It's just a guess. We're trying to find out through our friend who is in Las Cruces. But at this point in time, all we know is Don Angel was keeping track of these two kids. Were they Hitler's children? A lot of people think they were, and it's probably a good guess, but that's all it is right now is a guess.
Of course, we know the official story is that Hitler killed himself. Eva Braun took cyanide and killed herself. The bodies were taken out immediately and doused with fuel and set on fire. We know that the Russians scooped up some of the remains and fairly recently did some DNA tests. And
yep.
I think it was first announced that, oh, yeah, we've concluded that this was Hitler. But more recently, I guess the results are not quite as conclusive, not even conclusive at all. What do you know?
Well, just what you read in the press, some years ago, oh, 5, 6, 7 years ago, I guess, some forensic scientist did DNA testing on the skull, and it turns out it's the skull of a young woman. So no matter what you think of Hitler, he was not a cross-dresser. And they had the wrong pieces there. It wasn't Hitler. And we also read, I don't know how accurate it is, but the blood stains on the sofa were not the same blood type as Hitler. The dental records, we have information that that Hitler's dentist had to recreate the dental impressions, et cetera, of Hitler's teeth from memory, and that they didn't have x-rays of it. Now, who knows?
So do you think the Russians would have gone along with the deception to say, oh, yeah, these are Hitler's remains, we've got them, just to maybe take the sting out of the fact that they let him slip away?
That's a possibility, but remember, in June of 45, 3 months after the alleged suicide, Joseph Stalin was publicly screaming that England and the U.S. weren't doing enough to find Hitler's body. Well, if you got Hitler's body, why are you looking for him?
No.
And there were so many people, they're all listed in the book, who said they knew Hitler got away. He wasn't there. Stalin knew he got away. He told Truman at Potsdam. And there's another interesting thing. Down in that little town of Bariloche, where all the Germans were, and they had their own armed security on the water and also on land after the war, there's a beautiful big five-star, five-diamond resort hotel built in 1939 with German money, and it's open today. We go there for brunch. That's all we can afford. But there's a picture hanging in the lobby of Dwight Eisenhower standing in front of that hotel in 1960. What the heck is an American president doing down there in 1960, shortly after the war, unless there was something to look at?
And you have a quote from Eisenhower from 1952, and you would think if anybody would know, it would be Eisenhower. 1952, he says, we don't know what became of Hitler, right?
Exactly. Lots of people said the same thing. We don't know where he went. And so why the false story, I don't know, but I was a kid during the war year. And in the beginning, we were fighting Germany, Italy, and Japan. Later on, when it was obvious we were going to win the war and Italy surrendered, we were fighting Hitler, Tojo, and Mussolini. They had personalized the war to where they could rebuild the countries, but these three guys were the horrible villains. Mussolini, no question what happened to him, hung up by his heel and machine gun. Tojo shot himself, didn't die. We nursed him back to health and then hanged him. But Hitler, you can't very well say, well, we got two out of three. If you're batting 667 in the major leagues, you can get $1 million per baseball game. But at that time, they wanted to end the story. They wanted finality. And so Hitler blew his brains out in the bunker. And some reports say that he put the pistol in his mouth and bit down on a cyanide pill at the same time. Tell me how you can bite down on anything when you got a gun barrel in your mouth. Unless it's Clark Kent.
Of course, there's a lot of speculation about if he had been alive, if the FBI, well, we know the FBI did have tips and had files about the possibility it was alive, why no one went down and found him, in particular, the Mossad. Let's take the Mossad to begin with. We're going to take a break here in about a minute. So,
okay. All right. Well, you know, people ask me, why didn't they go after him? And so I ask them, well, who's they? Oh, well, then they stumble and say, well, Israel. No, there was no Israel in 1945. Israel didn't even come into existence until 48. Well, what about the Mossad? Well, there was, if the Mossad even existed at that time, it was very small and not so powerful. Well, why didn't the U.S. go after him? There's a story there, and you have to take a break, and we can pick that up after the break if you like.
Yeah, I think so. But we had Simon Wiesenthal, folks like that. They would have certainly been interested, I would think.
Yeah, when did Wiesenthal get started, though? He didn't get big until the late 40s, early 50s.
Sure.
If I remember correctly.
Yeah, I tell you what, we'll take this break. We'll come back. I'll ask about why the U.S. wouldn't have gone down, because I think think you got a brilliant, interesting answer to that. Maybe a deal was cut. We'll take the break, and then we'll be opening up the phone lines with your questions for Harry Cooper about his book, Hitler in Argentina,